This is Perry Marshall. I am here with Brian Kurtz. Brian is the director of marketing at Boardroom Reports and Bottom Line Publications, which is a deeply respected, very successful direct marketing publishing company. And Boardroom marries the very best of the traditional corporate world, which, you know, some publishers are very large, with the guerrilla, street smart world of copywriting and direct mail and web marketing and, you know, like every tool, every trick in the book. If you become familiar with the world of professional copywriters, the best writers will always brag that they've written controls for Boardroom. And I'm here interviewing Brian today. So, Brian, welcome.
Oh, thanks.
Glad you're here.
Total pleasure. I followed your career, and you asking me to do an interview with you was as flattering as anything. So thank you.
So, Brian, what I wanted to talk to you about today was I wanted you to talk about three of the most surprising things that you've ever learned in your 32 years of marketing history. And, Brian, you know, you've meticulously tracked the results of all kinds of things, you know, the stuff that ends up in your waste paper basket is better than what, you know, most people's flagship promotion. So like, this really is creme de la creme, and so you said, well, all right, so I will have three interesting case studies and stories for you. So, Brian, is there anything you want to say about, just to let everybody get to know you a little bit better before we dive into this material here?
Sure. I'll make it brief. I mean, I just love direct marketing. I love the fact that, you know, I'm not a dinosaur. I'm a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I'm not a thing. And I just love that fact because what I'm finding, you know, hanging out with the best online marketers in the world, I tell them, you know, why do you want to, if you call yourself an internet marketer, then I think you're being silly, because why do you want to define yourself by a channel?
Yes.
And my first case history is about the ultimate multi-channel marketing effort that I ever did in my career. Because I'm just not a direct mail guy either. So, you know, for me, people like describe my career and they say, wow, man, you've crushed it in all media. You've crushed it in direct mail, and you've crushed it's a word that I never used. You've crushed it in direct mail, and you've crushed it in TV, and you've crushed it in online marketing. And my response is, yeah, if I had crushed it in all three at the same time, my whole career, I'd be on an island probably in Fiji or something. Although I probably wouldn't, because I love direct marketing too much and I'd still want to do stuff or
yep.
something else or whatever. But, you know, the idea that you know, old, it's not just old is new again, and it's not like I want to be grandpa at every single conference I go to. You know, I do have one slide that I use a lot, which is, you know, my career, I have a slide, it's a picture, it says, I think the slide says something like, my childhood in direct marketing. And it has a picture of a guy walking, like, in the snow with a briefcase and a suit, like, uphill. And I said, you know, in the early days of direct marketing, I walked to work every day, uphill, in the snow, barefoot, and boy, was I working hard. And then I click, and I it says, and I pay postage. And the reason why I say that, I mean, it's, on the one hand, it's funny, and on the other hand, it's like, that's what made me such a great marketer. You know, the fact that I understood that if I'm paying $200, $300, $400, $500 a thousand for direct mail, that I paid tens of thousands of dollars for A-plus copywriters, and I've got, you know, design, and I'm paying for paper and all, and postage. In fact, there was one year I remember I was lobbying for postal reform in D.C., and I was with a bunch of huge companies like AARP and National Geographic, And they, you know, who's this little company Boardroom from Connecticut? And I said, well, you know, we're not that big, but our postal bill last year was $22 million. So I got their attention anyway.
And to date, you guys have mailed 1.3 billion pieces of mail.
In the last 20 years, we've mailed 1.3 billion pieces of direct mail.
That's a lot of letters.
Yeah, and I lift every stamp, too. So I'm very versatile. So the point there was that, you know, because I learned, you know, again, I don't want to sound like the dinosaur or grandpa, but because I learned the disciplines of direct marketing under the cost constraints of direct mail, everything had to be perfect. Everything had to be, you know, every piece of mail that I sent out had to be not just achieve something, it had to, like, usually had to sell something and had to do it elegantly because I couldn't afford to send love gifts. I couldn't afford to just, you know, do direct mail and say, hi, how are you? You know, here's a free special report for the hell of it. And so coming full circle, when I look at the online world, you know, I think that there are too many marketers that don't understand that every email they send, even if it doesn't sell something, it better achieve something.
Yeah.
And the people that do launches the best and the people that do online marketing with all of this in mind are the ones I respect the most, and they're the ones that really understand long-term value of your database, understanding your customer and how you segment your list and how you don't send everything the same to every person. And you can do more and more of that these days on email than you couldn't have some time ago. And we were doing that in direct mail even before, in the 1960s when I was in grade school. You know, Reader's Digest understood regression modeling in the 1960s and that you don't mail the same thing to everybody. So, you know, I don't want to talk about my credentials or my career in that respect. What I really just love is that, you know, I am like the most welcome dinosaur at every place I've gone in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
I just love being that person. I just love sharing what I've done, and people think that they're getting the better end of the deal because they're getting all my knowledge, and little do they know that I'm always getting the better end of the deal because I don't even ask them to share, and they're sharing stuff that I never could learn on my own. And so it's one of those perfect situations of just it's not even quid pro quo. It's just, you know, total masterminding at the highest level. And I'd say right now I'm as fulfilled in what I'm doing in my career as I've ever been, despite, you know, whatever failures we have day to day and things that are struggled because of the economy or whatever. Direct mail is tougher only because there are fewer great list universes out there. But direct mail still works. Direct mail still scales. And I've got the attention of a lot of internet marketers who have postal address lists that they can understand. When they get wind of how much emptier the mailboxes are, and if they do killer direct mail, how they could get the edge on everybody else if they start thinking themselves about as multi-channel marketers and not as internet marketers, well, the world's their oyster. Those are the guys I really want to spend time with.
Well, that's where the scale is.
Absolutely.
And I like what you say about mastermind. I wouldn't be caught dead not being in a great mastermind. I'm actually in a couple myself.
I'm actually.
Right?
Yeah. So.
So Brian, so you got three interesting stories to tell today.
Yes. Yeah, so the first one, I mean, it's a good segue. I'm not doing these in chronological order in my career. I want to do them in they're not in any order except that I want to talk about the multi-channel one because it's so fascinating, and it really, there's so many lessons that I learned from this, and I hope that, you know, your listeners get something really good from it. And I've told it a few times on various stages. But basically, you know, in the I'll go back to the mid-1980s, maybe late 1980s, when Tony Robbins was becoming an incredible phenomenon on infomercials, on direct response television. That was like right around, I don't know all the details because I was very young then, but I was 9 years old, by the way. So it was like, you know, late 80s maybe, and basically the infomercial business exploded because all of a sudden, I guess the FTC or the FCC, I think it was the FCC, opened up this idea that you could buy half-hour time and it could be, you know, kind of programming / advertising. There was like a big breakthrough at that point. I don't know the legality. So anyway, Tony Robbins is just rocking it. I mean, don't know if you remember those times, but he was just, you know, the infomercial king, and then there were a bunch of others right after that. And at that time, we had just come off at Boardroom selling a book called The Book of Inside Information, which was kind of the greatest hits of our bottom line personal newsletter. It was like a 500-600-page book. We actually had sold 3 million copies of that one title at like $30 or $40 a copy in direct mail only over a few-year period. So this was like, you know, I don't even care about the New York Times bestseller list when you're selling 3 million copies in direct mail and you don't even care, and you know that the margins are better than selling, you know, at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
It was just a whole incredible. So I remember, you know, the guys who were doing the kings of the infomercials then, and they still are, I guess, were Guthy Renker. And so Marty Edelston, our founder, and I had a meeting with Bill Guthy Renker in New York City, and I said, you know, I'm just so enamored with what's going on with the infomercial world, and I think we have great products. You know, Tony Robbins is giving people a life course on how to, you know, run their life, and I think Bottom Line could offer, you know, the Bottom Line Better Life course, and it could include a bunch of our books and our newsletters and blah, 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 blah. So one thing led to another. They, you know, nothing happened from that idea. And the reason why I give that, because it's the first lesson was never give up on a dream or never give up on something that you kind of believe is right, but it may not be right at that particular time. I didn't have the right product. I didn't have whatever. But the thing that I did know at the time is that A, I wanted to get into TV in some way, and B, I had a brand, Bottom Line, that was just not that well known. So selling Sports Illustrated on a 2-minute Sports Illustrated subscriptions on a 2-minute TV commercial is kind of easy to do, because everybody knows your brand. Everybody knows it's all about price and giving away a free football phone or whatever they were giving away. Whereas if I did a 2-minute commercial for Bottom Line Personal or the Book of Inside Information, nobody's going to be interested in that. And I did try some 2-minute TV for Book of Inside Information. It didn't do well at all. But what I saw in the infomercial was that now I could take my kind of direct mail, which was always long direct mail. You know, I was never doing, you know, 2-page letter direct mail. I was doing 20-page magalogs and bookalogs and, you know, I mean, long copy is an understatement for what Bottom Line was doing, because I had a great story to tell. And I had to tell that story because I was an unknown brand in a marketplace with whatever noise was going on with known brands. So I wasn't even going to be able to compete with Consumer Reports or Money Magazine or whoever, you know, even though our content was competitive in some ways, I couldn't compete. So I guess my analogy was, you know, short-form TV, you know, 1-minute, 2-minute TV was to known brands as infomercials were to brands that needed longer selling, like they were, like I did in direct mail. So I only give you all that background because there were some real lessons there about understanding the kind of marketing that I knew we needed to do to sell our stuff by what I did in direct mail for my first 10 years, and then how would I get that into TV? And to me, infomercial was like the magic bullet, and yet I couldn't get in because I couldn't get enough interest from whether it was Guthy or Renker, or just I couldn't come up with the right idea. So now fast forward, and I never gave up on the concept. Kept on thinking about it for years and years and years. So now we come to like 2004, maybe 2003, and I'm up one night because I can't sleep. I'm watching, you know, late night TV, and I was watching some infomercials. And there's Kevin Trudeau. He gets on TV, and he's selling a book, What They Don't Want You to Know. It was like a health book. I don't know if you remember the
Yeah, interview. Yeah.
And he's, you know, Kevin Trudeau is a guy that, you know, I don't like selling some of the things the way he sells them, and yet the guy is obviously a brilliant marketer, a brilliant salesman. And so he's selling this one book, and the book is $29.95. And I'm looking at it, and I'm saying, how I never would have thought that you could sell one book for $29.95 and pay for 30-minute media, infomercial media.
Huh.
So then I called the toll-free number, and they proceeded to keep me on the phone for I think it was 3.5 days with upsells and cross-sells, everything that Kevin could have thought of that was related to the book and everything that he partnered with that wasn't related to the book. I'm exaggerating, of course, but obviously it was all about the back end, and that I think the word on the street was that Kevin's average order on the $29.95 book was about $100 an order. So, and I don't know that for a fact, I'm just speculating. But I had my idea. So my failure to get into the infomercial business was now going to be my jump start, because I knew that I could sell a single book that had incredible amount of information. And I'm not saying, you know, if Kevin listens to this interview, I think I would tell him to his face that I think my book is much better than the book he was at. But not to say that his book was bad or whatever. I'm not going to make any comments on that. But my book, whether it was the Book of Inside Information, it ended up being one of my health books. It ended up being the Treasury of Health Secrets, and that's the case history here. So I have this Treasury of Health Secrets. It's a 600-page book. It's greatest hits from all of our best health stuff of the last couple of years. The book already exists. I've been using direct mail for it. And actually, the direct mail had almost died. I couldn't get a new control package for it. I was ready to kind of retire the book because I didn't have a promotion that was winning. And so I watched Kevin Trudeau. I start calling people. I don't want to go into all the little details, but I knew some people in the business. I knew a producer in the infomercial world that was winding down his business, and I knew he was a genius and a direct marketing. In fact, I'll even mention his name. His name is Steve Dwarman, and he actually wrote the book. He wrote a book about the infomercial marketing business, and he had a newsletter at the time called The Infomercial Marketing Report. And I called Steve because we were friends, and I said, I think I know how to do this, but I need some help. I don't want to sell everything under the sun on the back end, but if I can get my average order to $60 or $70, I think I can still do this. I've been, I costed it out and I figured it out. And then Steve knew everybody in the business, so I found my media buyer. I did everything I would have done if I was doing direct mail. And lo and behold, long story long, I launched an infomercial. Well, actually, I did three in a row. One was Treasury of Health Secrets. One was Treasury of Health Secrets Revised Edition. And then the third one was called Ultimate Healing, which was like a son of Treasury of Health Secrets. The first one, my host was Barry Farber, who was a well-known radio guy. And then my second and third were with Hugh Downs, the legendary newscaster. And I think, I don't want to exaggerate, I know that that infomercial business in 1 year took our business from a $60 million business, $70 million business, to $150 million. And over those 3 or 4 years, we ran that show. And then we also ran a second infomercial on another book using the same formula. And the back end was mostly other books of our own, stuff that we really felt comfortable with. Like, I didn't sell clubs on the back end. I didn't sell supplements. I didn't – just things I didn't want to do on the back end. And I think our total take in infomercials over a 3 or 4 year period had to be – I mean, it was definitely over $200 million. And then – so here's where – and here's where it just got totally cool. And this is when I was like Mr. Multi-Channel Marketer. I took the – remember I said my direct mail piece was dead. I couldn't get a new control. I had my copywriter take all the footage from the infomercial, which had all these doctors in it. It had, as Gary Bensifenga would say, proof elements up the wazoo. I had doctor pods. I had, I had so much stuff in there. The credibility was off the charts. I mean, Steve Dwarman just did a brilliant job. And we then did a tabloid direct mail piece, a 20-page or 24-page tabloid that had all the scenes from the infomercial with all the doctors in it. And it was a completely new control package. And lo and behold, the direct mail went through the roof. I had a completely revised direct mail program for a book that I was ready to retire in direct mail. Of course, at the time, I was running anywhere from $200,000 a week to $500,000 a week in TV media. And anybody who says all boats don't rise doesn't know what they're talking about. On the other hand, I don't want to just throw stuff at PR and publicity when you can't read it. I was actually reading response rates because I'm a direct marketer. Then, all of a sudden, I was able to do display ads on the internet with Hugh Downs' picture. And it was like, Hugh Downs reports. And I had, lower your cholesterol, and you click. And there's the landing page is all the stuff from the tabloid, from the direct mail, but it's online. And I was actually able to sell another million books online, million plus. And I actually did it with a bill me offer. I didn't even ask for credit card. And I was getting over 50% pay up, which is unheard of online. That eventually fizzled out when the pay up went below 50%. But for a period of time of like 3 years, we were basically just cranking it on all three channels. And it was one of the most exhilarating periods of marketing in my entire career. And so, surprise is not the exact word I would use for it, but it was... all things come to those who wait, personified, and all things, if you believe in something and you've got your gut in it, knowing that infomercials was going to be I knew I was going to get it to work at some point because it made sense. And then I'd say this was probably, from a boardroom perspective, certainly the crowning achievement of my career. So that case history one.
Well, so several things I see in that story. First of all, you're dealing in numbers that are orders of magnitude greater than most people who are listening. And it might be easy for a lot of people to overlook the fact that you're probably not operating on any separate set of principles than they are.
Correct.
You're just doing a better job of executing the details and probably dealing with a wider picture of what you're really about.
Exactly. I think that that's really well put, Perry. I guess not an analogy, but just sort of an image. You know, I always say that it costs us the same at Boardroom to do a million piece mailing as to do 100,000 piece mailing. When I say cost the same, I mean in terms of labor, in terms of, you know, real work.
Yeah, like engineering cost, product development, right?
So, you know, given that, you know, if you're always thinking in terms of multi-channel, I mean, I had this epiphany with, I was speaking at an internet marketing conference, first telling all of them not to define themselves by a channel. So I said, this is not an internet marketing conference, it's a multi-channel marketing conference. I renamed it in front of them.
It's good to redefine the conference you're speaking at, right?
Exactly, isn't that cool? So I did that first, and then I said, look, you know, you guys are sitting on postal address lists because you have all these postal addresses. You already are making a lot per customer if you're calculating lifetime value per customer. And you probably have thought about products that need a lot more selling than you can do with a subject line and an email. And so, you know, to overlook a channel like direct mail where, you know, people get 5% response rates still in 2013. We just did a mailing for a newsletter. I got 5% response rates. You just want to think about other things besides, you know, bombarding people with emails all day. So that has to do with size and scope. That has to do with taking care of your audience, understanding your audience, you know, working your database. And the thing that the internet guys really know well is that they can give away a lot of free content because they're not paying postage. So, you know, you've got the world, your oyster. Now, TV is a much tougher nut, obviously. And
yes.
You know, you don't want to try, it's like making sushi. I don't know if I want to try TV all the time. And it's just tough, you know, because the investment is high. You know, if you got a failure very quickly, and you don't recoup much. You know, like direct mail, if it costs me a couple $100,000 to launch a direct mail campaign for a book, and it's a disaster, my first mailing, I'll probably get $100,000 back. In TV, you could spend $200,000 on creative. You're going to spend $20,000 or $15,000 on a media test that'll tell you what the market thinks of your infomercial. If it bombs, you're kind of done. You know, so it is more of the one-hit wonder mentality. So I don't recommend TV, but, boy, you know, I think the other lesson I can't repeat enough, which I said at the beginning, is that I just believed that the story of one of our big encyclopedic books, whether it was health or consumer information, was just perfect for the medium called infomercial.
Mm.
And I never stopped believing it, not in a stubborn way, but because I really trust my marketing instincts on it.
Yeah, I really like what you're saying about keep making sure that those great ideas stay on the shelf and you're still incubating them rather than abandoning them. I think a lot of times human beings, we got this fantastic thing, we really believe in it, we put it out there, it bombs, and then we resent it, or we resent ourselves for it. And in doing that, we don't even realize that we have consigned it to the graveyard when really it wasn't ready to be born yet.
That's right. Right. That's a great analogy. If you put it on the shelf, you know, if you believed it, it's going to – you know what? And I always say, you know, Marty, our founder, was not a big computer guy because, you know, by the time the internet became popular, he was a lot older. But he always said, you know, he always looked at his brain as a computer. And even though he wasn't into computers, he said, I'm just storing that one away. And I don't know. if you're a smart marketer, which everybody on this call I'm assuming is,
yep.
Give yourself some credit at the beginning and don't question your gut. But that doesn't mean you have to spend a lot of money chasing the stuff in your gut every day, all day.
Yeah, totally. You know what else you said that sparked synapse was you went to this conference and you said, you know, this is not an internet conference, this is a multi-channel conference. You know, at Ken McCarthy's first seminar, which was April 2002, he got up and he said, "We are not internet marketers. We are direct marketers who use the internet as a medium."
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's how he began the first 30 minutes. It might have been the first 5 minutes.
That's awesome.
Okay, and of course, you know about the system seminar kind of really gave birth to half of what all is going on today.
Absolutely.
I know I understood exactly what he meant, and you kind of have to remember that this was post-dot-com crash, where, you know, half the people in the world are like, well, you know, I'm pretty sure this internet's going to take off. It was kind of like your idea on the shelf thing, like, yeah, you know, just give it a little more incubation time. It's going to come roaring.
Yeah.
Right, and there was also a part of it like, oh, you know, good grief, this might all just be a bunch of smoke and mirrors.
Right, right.
And that, you know, it was like it was the ripest possible time. And for him, you know, he had totally seen the light in everything in probably 94, 95, 96. And he's sitting there waiting for the giant stupidity spasm to subside. Right?
I love that.
And he was doing that seminar at the perfect time.
Yes. Actually, Gary Bensavenga, probably the best, greatest living copywriter, gave me a quote just last night. I'm going to unveil it at Underground in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's, why be a channel when you can be a solution?
Unpack that. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so basically what I mean, it's kind of like, you know, don't define yourself by a channel, but the idea that if you start thinking yourself as a solution to somebody's problems, like your business, again, you know, John Carlton has a great quote, a promotion is not a business.
Mm.
Farrell has a great quote, a product is not a business. You know, direct marketing, you know, right at the beginning of the Bible of direct marketing, which was written by Bob Stone, Successful Direct Marketing Methods, I think the quote is, you know, no direct marketing business can succeed without repeat business. And so we've known that forever. The internet marketers know that. But when you start looking at your whatever you're selling as a solution, you're not going to be in one product. You're not going to be in one promotion. You're not going to be in one channel. You're going to be like solving problems for people. You're going to be actually trying to change the world in some way.
Mm.
And whether you're teaching people, you know, in the info world, you know, how to be a better marketer, which is a lot of what goes on. But there's a lot of people that are teaching people how to be better dog trainers and better, raisers, you know, raising of horses and you know, better ways to use herbs in cooking. And, you know, how great is it when you're working in your passion? So when Gary said it, the word solution, to me anyway, said, you know, go work in your passion, you know, because ultimately that's going to fuel you. Then making the back end product isn't going to be a chore. It's going to be part of your DNA. And then you've got a real direct marketing business.
Amen. You mentioned something. You said pay up offers. And
bill me offers.
Offers. Now, I don't think most people have ever even contemplated such a thing. Can
right.
you explain?
Yes. It's dangerous on the internet, of course, because you can't credit screen. In direct mail, I mean, get this. So, you know, we met 1.3 billion pieces of direct mail in the last 20 years. Almost all of that direct mail that went out, in the original solicitation piece, we never asked for cash or credit card. we basically said you can try this newsletter for 6 months for free, and we build you, or you could take this book as a free trial for 30 days, and then we send you a bill, and we send you a series of bills if you don't pay us. Now, the bill me model in direct mail, obviously, you have so many better controls. Before you go out with a direct mail campaign, we do what we call merge purge, which is we take all of our lists, we merge them together, we take out the duplicates, we identify the multi-buyers, we do all that kind of, you know, segmentation, and at the same time, you can actually run credit screens. And by a credit screen, you might know, because of data you could buy on the outside, how many people on that list that you're ready to go out in the mail with and pay postage, remember? I'm looking those stamps. And you're going out with that postage, and all of a sudden you realize there's people on that list that have a bad credit rating. They've actually stiffed six other book people, and they never paid. And so you have a criteria that says, I'm not going to mail those names, but everybody else I'm going to mail. And then the people I do mail, I can offer a bill me offer, a free trial. And so just, you know, for argument's sake, you know, and then I've got my house file, people who've already bought from me. So I already have their payment history. I know that they like my brand because they bought from me already, and I can trust them to buy on a bill me offer. So interestingly, so let's go back to the multi-channel. So on the infomercial, everything was capped. You call on the toll-free number, you have to give a credit card. I'm not doing any bill me's on an infomercial. You just can't afford to do it. You're paying way too much for the media, and again, you can't credit screen on an infomercial. However, at the same time when I was doing the, remember, then I said I ramped up the direct mail using the creative from the infomercial. And in that direct mail, you know what one of my selling points was? I guess you can guess because I know you're a copy guy. Was, you know, for you, special person that's on my list for direct mail, whether you're a house customer or not, I'm going to give you a free trial of the book, which wasn't available on TV. You couldn't get the book for free on TV.
Nah.
So now I've got another selling point that says, because you're on my special direct mail list, I'm going to give you a free trial. And those people pay up at 70, you know, maybe 70 to 80%. The people that don't pay, a lot of them return the book, and the book is still usable when we can go back out with it. And then there's, you know, 10% of the people who just stiff you. And you put that as a cost of doing business. But net-net, when you're doing a bill me offer, your response rates could be double. Imagine if I'm letting you see a free trial of a book as opposed to having you put your credit card in. You can imagine I'm going to get double the response. Now, the interesting thing that I found as I'm dealing with all these online marketers is that in the subscription area, in the newsletter business and magazine business, I mean, you subscribe, everybody on this call is probably subscribed to a magazine where there's a bill me later option because, you know, it's very hard to get an offer from Money Magazine or Vanity Fair, and they're usually not going to make you pay up front. So you get a free issue, or you get three free issues, and then they send you a bill. And if you think about it, they're doing that. They have a benefit to do that because they have advertising in those magazines. So it's called rate-based advertising. So for the 3 months that you're on their list and you haven't paid yet, they can still count that as eyeballs for their advertising in their magazine. So there's a benefit there.
Oh, okay.
And in addition to that, think about it. The launch people that are doing the best online, what are they doing? Aren't they giving away content until they decide to sell you something?
Absolutely.
What were magazine people doing in the 1950s and 60s?
Mm.
They're giving you six free issues. You're trying it before you buy it. And then hopefully at the end of 6 months, you love it so much that you're eating out of their hand by the time you send them a bill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the concept anyway. So, you know, the idea of bill me is such an incredible concept. The problem with the internet, and the reason why it was so amazing that we could sell books on display ads on the internet on a bill me offer, I was shocked. I mean, I think that is something I wouldn't try so quickly unless it was a digital product that you could download. But even there, you know, then, you know, getting paid is going to be tough. So, you know, bill me is not the perfect thing for the internet. I got that. But I guess I use that for effect because all boats were rising in this multi-channel approach. There was a period of time where I was doing bill me in direct mail, I was doing cash with order on TV, and I was actually able to do bill me online, which was amazing. And eventually I had to go to cash with order online as well, but just an interesting phenomenon. You know, when your product is that hot and people have such desire for it, there's a lot of things you can do. And again, BillMe offers are going to increase your response rate, and there's an acceptable pay-up that's going to make it worthwhile if it pays for the bad debt.
Well, I got to think that a sizable percentage of people could find a way for that to be very advantageous to whatever they're doing. So that's gold.
It is gold. And here's a dream of mine. A dream of mine is, and we're not far from it because I know companies that are working on this. Imagine someone goes to a display ad on the internet, clicks on an ad, you go to a book offer, and it's not digital, it's a physical book. And then they go to buy the book, and in real time, there's a database of that email address that's sitting on a database somewhere. This is sort of the credit screen that you can do in direct mail that you can't do in online. So as long as the offer initially says something to the effect of, you know, here's a free offer for a free trial for the book, subject to approval, I think is the wording you use. So the person clicks, and they're a horrible bad debtor, right? They're someone who never pays for anything. What happens is, as soon as they say free trial, they actually then, in real time, go to a page where they have to put their credit card in because they're not credit worthy enough to give a BillMe offer to. And then there are people that go to this in real time, their credit screen, that they pass whatever criteria that you set. You could set that criteria, you know, if they have three bad debts on their file, I'm not giving them more credit, or whatever the criteria is, and you test that. Then those people are given the BillMe offer because the chances of them paying at that 60-70% clip are much higher then. The technology is available to do this. We tried it. It didn't work well enough. The cost of the credit screen defeated the advantages of offering the BillMe offer.
Oh, okay.
But that's 2012. What do you think is going to happen this year or next year? Right, it's going to get better.
You're right. I don't know if you know Ben Morris.
I do, and I know he's working on a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You know, we do something a little bit similar to that, which is when somebody opts into our website, we go to Ben's database in real time, and we append all this information. And we know that there are certain clusters of people that are much better buyers for us than others. And we segment that stuff in real time. And when we do direct mail, you know, most of our leads have come to us on the internet somehow. We do some of that kind of screening. So, you know, I think that this is really something for people to bookmark that, you know, we might only be a year away from being able to do that affordably, like you're describing, and
it could be a major breakthrough if you could get qualified buyers in cold traffic off the internet without having to put their credit card in right away.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
So tell me your second interesting tale.
I'll make these a lot shorter. That was a pretty long case history, so I apologize, but. So here are just two quickies, not quickies, but just these are really interesting. So one of my mentors in the 80s was a guy by the name of Gordon Grossman, and Gordon was one of the architects at Reader's Digest in the 1960s. I won't say he invented sweepstakes, but he was like one of the first people that really understood how powerful sweepstakes and contests could be in direct mail. And, you know, fast forward to Groupon and Living Social, you know, there are things like that were invented a long time ago, just for the record. And so Gordon, again, one of my mentors, tremendous direct mail guy. In fact, we published his memoirs called Confessions of a Direct Mail Guy. And Gordon was consulting with us, and most of our best-selling books, remember I told you about the Book of Inside Information, and basically we were great, like Marty understood how to repurpose content way before most people did. I even think he invented hypertext before the internet.
Hmm.
So he, this Book of Inside Information, we sold 3 million copies in direct mail. That Treasury of Health Secrets that died and then was rebirthed after the infomercial, that sold over 1 million copies in direct mail. But all of them were greatest hits of our newsletters, like all of it was our own content. And so Gordon says to me, and Gordon had this gruff voice, and Gordon looks at me one day and he goes, what makes you think that all your content has to be your own? And I said, wow, that's an epiphany, right? And I'm thinking, okay, what content would I want to do? And so, I mean, and this is based on like, at that point, maybe 10 years training in database marketing, in segmenting our list, knowing the categories that work best, knowing all of the outside lists that work best. And I literally went with my marketing guy, and we went to Barnes. I always say, I think the slide when I talk about this case history says something like, I went to Barnes & Noble and used one of their hand trucks. And what I did was I went into every category at Barnes & Noble that was a category that was obviously a category that appealed to my audience. So, for example, I take the and the guys at Barnes & Noble let me use a hand truck. And I went to the health segment, of course, and I put a bunch of health books on my hand truck that look really good.
Hmm.
Books that look like they had tons of tidbits, information, useful information, as close to what we would do on our own if it was our content.
Huh.
But I really didn't know if it was good or not because I wasn't going to read the books at Barnes & Noble. Back then, there was no coffee shop at Barnes & Noble. So I didn't want to stay there very long. I just wanted to get my hand truck and get out, right?
Yeah.
So I went to the health. I went to the tax area. I went to the investment area. I went to the car area, travel area. And I remember we bought, I don't know, $300-$400 worth of books that night. And I loaded them into my car, brought them to the office the next day, and then actually had my book editor started going through them. And the ones that she thought had some potential for being able to write great copy from for direct mail, we sent those to a couple of our A copywriters and said, do you think you could do direct mail for one of these books? Now, remember, a lot of these books, you know, what's a bestseller at that point in Barnes & Noble? You know, an author does a book, he gets an advance, and then he never sees another dime because they're only selling 3,000 books in its history, or 4,000 or 5,000. You know, you sell 8,000 books, you think you're like a best-selling author. And so we started taking a look at these books, and it was amazing. So this maybe was the surprise, that when I found a book, and I think the first one was a book by a naturopathic guy named Gary Null, N-U-L-L, pretty well known. He was on PBS and kind of some wacky health stuff, but not, you know, very interested in, you know, nutrition, and he had some woo-woo stuff in his books too, but generally, you know, a guy that had good stuff to say. I saw on the binding, so one of my copywriters said, there's a lot of good stuff in here, I think I could write a direct mail piece for this. And lo and behold, I called the publisher. So happened the woman at the, this is a trade publisher now. This is like typical New York City. They weren't big. It wasn't John Wiley and it wasn't, you know, HarperCollins or Penguin. But it was a company, I think, called Kensington. So it was a mid-sized publisher. There was a woman there who I actually knew from the direct marketing world who went into the trade book business. Went and met with her. Said, all I want to do is buy the direct mail rights to this book. I'll pay you a royalty and we'll see where it goes.
Huh.
And I did not think it was going to be that easy, and it was like simple because the book was, you know, like it was a good book. It was collecting dust on the shelf at Barnes & Noble when I got it. I think maybe my criteria with that hand truck was like which books are in my best categories that have the most dust on them. But then knowing that I had a copywriter interested already, basically what I did is I went through the book. It was actually, that book in particular, it was called The Encyclopedia of Natural Healing. It was too big. For direct mail. It was like, I don't know, 900 pages or something.
Huh.
So we had our editors cut it down to 500 or 600 pages. We then created a couple of premiums, like some little booklets that we created with our own content. So I violated Gordon Grossman a little bit that I still wanted to throw in some of our own content, knowing that our house file would like that. And I created a package called The Encyclopedia of Natural Healing by Gary Null, with three or four little booklets of special premiums on special topics. And even though the book was still sitting on the shelf in the bookstore, I just created this apples to oranges selling proposition. So I had this brand new product, and I think at the time the book in the bookstore was probably discounted at like $19.95, I don't know. And my book, with bottom line books on the spine and these extra premiums, I was selling at $29.95. And I was selling it as a bill me because I knew the credit rating of my house customers. And long story short, I think I think we hit the million mark in terms of sales of that book over maybe a 4 or 5 year period. I know we sold at least 800,000 books. So I don't know what Gary had sold or in Kensington had sold as a trade book, but talk about the power of direct mail. And, you know, I'm very proud of this story only because I kind of invented our book business based on taking the stodgy trade publishers and going to them and saying, you're never going to do direct mail. I know how to do direct mail. Give me the rights. And we've had dozens of books that I bought the right, just the direct marketing rights to. In some cases, I bought direct marketing rights, not just direct mail rights. So that gave me the opportunity to go on the internet if I chose. And basically, our book business became, instead of, you know, 3 or 4 books, it became, you know, 20 books, 22 books. And we had an annual. One of our books was a book that you got on an annual basis, like the old yearbooks, but it was called the Bottom Line Yearbook, which was all our content. And I said, I really want to do a health yearbook. And in that particular case, I knew I couldn't create enough content to create a book every year, so I found a company that was sort of like a Reuters for health information, like they were like a health news service. And I partnered with them to give me enough content, which they're producing every day, so I could produce an annual book every year. And we still have a health annual. We've had the Bottom Line annual since 1992. I think we launched the health annual in 2001, because I have a bottle of wine here, and I don't drink, so it's still sitting on my shelf. 10-year anniversary with our partner, 2011. We've done that annual book for 10 years. So anyway, you know, here's an example of, you know, I know what my core strength was. It was repurposing content in direct mail, and all it took was one of my great mentors of all time reading me, you know, basically reading me the Riot Act, that how are you going to expand this business unless you think more creatively? And then realizing that this was going to be a lot easier, that the trade publishers were so happy with a 4.5% or 5% royalty. They made more money on my royalty than they did on the original deals.
Huh. Man, that's great. Well, you know, this makes me want to ask you a question, which is, so the whole world of publishing, of information marketing, of books, of everything is in turmoil because of, let's just call it, the Amazon Kindle phenomenon.
Okay.
Okay? Just to put a simple label on it.
Right.
All right. Oh, well, you know, everything's $9.95, and some days it's free, and some days it's 99 cents, and,
right,
you know, the bottom is falling out of all this. What is your perspective on that sentiment?
You know, I think that there is some truth there. I mean, content is ubiquitous. People online are used to getting everything for free. But I think it's getting more and more about niche, so that maybe a general health book launched today won't be as good. But we launched a book, a women's health book, only a year ago or 2 years ago, and that was a big success. We have a diabetes book, which is a big success. We have a book called The Healing Kitchen, which is a big success. And is all of that content technically available online? Of course it is. But online for free? Of course it is. But I think I learned from Marty in the 1980s that Bottom Line Personal was more about packaging as much as it was about, you know, blue chip content. I mean, it's great content, but you have to have the combination of the blue chip content and the packaging that makes it so that this is just going to be too hard to compile on my own. And because direct mail, you can tell such a good story. You not only can tell a story enough to sell enough books to have a profitable business, you can also charge a higher price because the story enriches everything than something just sitting on the internet as sort of like loose content. But I also think the packaging is so important, so that the idea of creating additional premiums with a book so that it becomes almost like a kit or a program or a plan, something people can follow. So it's changing what people are going to pay for, I think. But the concept that you can't sell content and people won't pay for content, I mean, I might as well pack up my bags now. You know, why do I want to believe that? Now, do I think that giving away a lot of free content to eventually get them to pay for content is a great model? Yeah. I mean, the best guys who do launches online are killing it doing that. But eventually, they got to get paid. So, you know, as it pertains to direct mail, I think there's still life there. I worry about the shrinking universes outside lists, for outside lists, because everybody's, you know, following the shiny object of how to monetize on Kindle or on in the iTunes store or on Google. And, you know, I think actually by saying that, the contrarian argument would be let them all go, let them all abandon this, and let's figure out how to create an incredible opportunity. Because, you know, I think I made a joke at one of the conferences I was at. I said, I don't know what the, you probably know this better than I do, but there's some number of, you know, someone who's on a page online with their hand on the mouse, you know, you probably have, what, 0.6 seconds or something. They're going to click off, right?
Right.
So my joke was, well, you have points. I think I used the term 0.6. I don't know if I'm sure I'm accurate within a half a second. And so 0.6 seconds. And with direct mail, yes, they might be sorting their mail over a garbage can, but I bet you have at least 1.8 seconds. So you got three times more time. And I was making it a joke to kind of illustrate the point that, you know, engaging direct mail is going to be it's a whole different game. You're playing in a different world. And if you're going to do that half-assed, it's not going to work, so forget it. If you're not committed to it, then don't do it. If you're not going to read the books and you're not going to take the training and you're not going to learn how to do it. So I don't know if I answered the question. I don't want to throw my arms up and give up because content is free everywhere. I think, to me, that's just so easy to say that. And there is a lot of truth in it. But damn, I just see response rates in direct mail that are as good today as they were 20 years ago. For the right product with the right creative to the right list, it's gold.
You know, I had a conversation. I was at a TED conference, and I bumped into the director of marketing for Playboy. Now, Playboy is not like my, you know, cup of tea, really.
Right.
But I was really curious to talk to him. He had been hired not terribly long before that, and you know, so they'd gone on this headhunting mission, and he had done several other companies and had various exploits, and so he's having the job interview, and they were saying to him, you know, this thing is going in the wrong direction, and you know we're hoping that we can, you know, reverse it and all that. And he goes, "Are you guys kidding?" He goes, "Every media company, every internet centric media company, this, you know, in all these other fields is killing it. Like,
right.
What's the matter with you?"
Right.
And one of the things that he told me was that they had figured out that the demographic for their customers was pretty much identical to gamers, and that their company was now a front end for gaming. And they had basically all these affiliate relationships for people paying to do gaming. Now, playing games is paying for content.
Yes.
It's not the same as books.
There's a guy that just sold like a game app for like tens of millions of dollars.
Yes. So, you know, there's a lot of directions a person could go. But, you know, deciding that you're obsolete, you know, I think what this really illustrates is that you need to have something that's more interesting than the simple, obvious thing that everybody else has always done.
Correct.
Right? That's what you're describing. So,
great product, great list, great product, great list, great promotion. The world's your oyster. And every channel is open to you. You know, I own the URL dinosaursandcowboys.com, and that's kind of what I'm living into at this point.
Mm.
You know, and as I said, I'm T-Rex, so I may be I may be an extinct dinosaur, but the fact that I'm actually I'm not. Since I'm a non-extinct Tyrannosaurus Rex, I can tear you apart.
So tell me your third story.
So this one will be the fastest, I think. So I was a list guy my first 10 years. I mean, I was lucky me. I mean, I got to Boardroom in 1981, and my first job was actually marketing and selling or renting the bottom line Boardroom mailing list. Which were, you know, because we didn't take advertising in our newsletters, so the only way to reach the audience was through our lists. So that's how I met everybody in direct response, because our list was so good. I don't have to sell you on them, but I could sell you a list now if you asked me to. But but the bottom line list, because we have these newsletters of very affluent people. We had a lot of executives on the list. They were mail order buyers. They were buying books. They were buying newsletter subscriptions. So they had so many things going for them, both in demographics, psychographics. So I basically could sell our list to everybody. I was selling to, you know, the money magazines. I could sell to Playboy. I could sell to, but if they sell, I mean, you rented lists at that, and you still do in direct mail. You rent them for one-time use. People weren't mailing for you, although you could do endorsed mailings, which is how the affiliate business got invented. Any affiliate who doesn't think their business wasn't invented in the 1960s by people doing endorsed mailings or anything. But the mailing list business was a very, very big business for direct mail. And we exchanged a lot of names. And lucky me, Boardroom, most companies gave their list to an outside list manager. And in Boardroom's case, we managed it in-house because we didn't have advertising. And Marty was a sales guy in his previous life before he started Boardroom. And he kind of wanted to keep the sales opportunity close to the vest. And I became this great sales guy. I mean, I was a real star in the list business. I mean, I'm really proud to say it. You know, some people say they never want to admit that they worked in the mailing list business. I am so proud of it because I learned marketing from the audience perspective. I learned, you know, how you get response from a list and how you segment a list and what attributes of a list are most important. So the story quickly is that the language of the list business were what they call data cards, and they still exist. I mean, they're all online now, but they were actual physical cards, usually 6x9, and you'd have the name of the list on it. You'd have how many names were available. The language of the list business was always called RFM. R stands for recency, F stands for frequency, M stands for monetary value. So recency meant that, you know, a name that bought in the last 3 months was worth more than a name that bought 6 months ago, which was worth more than a name that bought 12 months ago.
You know what, Brian? I have customers who think I invented that.
Oh, okay. I like you enough, Perry, that I'll go along with that reason. So that's and they called them hotlines. So that was the recency. Frequency was if they bought twice in the last 3 months or 6 months, they were better because that's a multi-buyer. That's what we call the multi-buyer. And then monetary value, you know, what they spent on the product could make a difference. If they spent, you know, $100 for a product versus $20, you know, depending on the offer, the $100 might have been a better name. Not always, by the way, and I have a lot of exceptions of why when that's not true, actually, where the higher monetary value is not the key focus for that particular offer. The thing that I started doing research, and then when I got into marketing after being selling lists for so long, and then I was buying lists, for Boardroom, to when I started on that 1.3 billion name quest to be the big mailer, I would read data cards of other lists. And can I use any profanity in this call?
If you want.
Most data cards were just full of shit.
big surprise.
So I started doing tons of research on figuring out, like, what was really behind the list, or what was the list manager, who were the people that were selling the list, what were they hiding in that data card? And then I wrote this article, which I still have, and it's one of my favorite things that I ever did, and I probably wrote it, must have been in the late 80s, and it was published in one of the trade magazines, and it's been requoted and republished in a bunch of places, and the title was Data Cards, Guilty Until Proven Innocent. And my concept was that, you know, you're spending all this money on printing and postage and all the things that we go into a direct mail campaign, and the list might be the most important thing. And because if you send a great package to the wrong list, it's never going to respond.
Yeah.
And basically, list managers were just trying to sell volume. It was a volume business. And some of them were stupid, and they didn't realize that if the list didn't work after they sold you the wrong names, they're coming back.
Yeah.
But they didn't get that. But I said, I'm going to protect my company, and I developed this worksheet. I mean, this was all kind of like a surprise to me, because having sold lists with incredible integrity for so long, like let me give you an obvious example. So I'm my book buyer list, and say my Book of Inside Information was my big selling book. So I've got this list, and I've got a 30,000 name 3-month hotline, and they've all bought Book of Inside Information. I'd make sure that the person I'm selling that list to knew that, so they'd know the type of book it was.
Mm.
And the next 3 months, I get a new hot book called The Treasury of Health Secrets. Now, Book of Inside Information is not just health, it's more consumer. So now, in the next 3 months, my hotline is 30,000 names, but 90% of it is Treasury of Health Secrets, not Book of Inside Information. And the company that took a test mailing of the 5,000 Book of Inside Information names last quarter comes back and says, I want your hotline. And if I don't tell them that my product mix changed, they could get screwed on the rollout.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what happened in the list business a lot, you know, and the cost was horrendous, right? I mean, we're not talking about 70 cents a thousand for email. $500 a thousand in direct mail, or $300 a thousand. So I just became this sleuth, and I was known in the industry as the guy that wouldn't mail your list unless you could prove to me that the names I took in my test look like the same names I'm taking in my rollout. Also, one of the things I learned in all of that sleuthing, if that's a word, was that the promotion, the type of promotion, sometimes was the most important thing. So, for example, if I was renting a list from Rodale Press, a health book list, and I knew that Gary Bensavenga wrote the package for the Rodale book that dominated that list, and Gary Bensavenga had the control for my book, would you believe me when I said that that was one of my best lists?
That's a big surprise.
Yeah. No, I wasn't. I mean, I knew I was going to prove this out, but the majority of the business didn't understand that the source goes beyond just whether it was direct mail or space or TV. The source could be the copywriter that wrote the package that got the name, or maybe the type of promotion that got the name, whether it was a number 10 envelope or a magalog or a bookalog or something like that. And then if I have that same format in direct mail, lo and behold, those were some of my best lists. And that was sometimes a situation where it didn't even matter what the cost of the product was. That was always more powerful than the fact that the product cost $10, $20, or $50.
That, I have found that to be immensely true. When I do work with affiliates, how close my personality is to the affiliate.
Exactly.
You know, if they send an email and their language and their style is like a complete mismatch to mine, you know, I might even need to rewrite a sales page to be more in their voice instead of mine, even if it's supposedly me speaking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you know, again, where am I going to put the surprise here? I guess the surprise was that when I sort of like started writing about this in the trades and everything, I was a celebrity for it. You know, that was a surprise, because I'm saying, why wouldn't everybody want to do this to protect themselves against, you know, bad rollouts from tests, which was always a big complaint in the direct mail business. And in fact, I'm always so proud. One of the great journalists in direct mail at the time was a guy by the name of Denny Hatch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, anybody who's ever could get a hold, and Denny's written a bunch of books about, you know, tips and tricks of direct marketing and all that. And he has a book of, like, quotes from great direct mail guys. And all, I mean, legends are in this book. And the fact that I'm in this book with the quote, data cards are guilty until proven innocent, one of the highlights of my career. And, you know, I tell you, it was just, I was thinking about it this morning because I know you wanted three stories, and I had the first two. And this one was sort of obvious, and I hadn't thought of it. And I said, you know what, it was a crowning achievement. It was early in my career. But I got to tell you, all of those skills about, as you just said, you just gave a great example how applicable that is today for doing affiliate marketing online.
You know, I think if you kind of zoom out from the story you just told, it's the list is the real gold in the direct marketing business.
I agree.
And it's funny how the way planet Earth seems to work is a lot of times the gold is guarded by the thieves.
Yeah.
Like, really, the list business in general is a really shady, carpetbagger, dishonest business at the bottom level.
Agreed.
It's like any business where, you know, the bottom 40% is like dreck.
Right, right.
And you know, they just want to sell you the list at, you know, what, $15 a thousand or whatever, and make their commission, and they don't see any kind of big picture at all.
No. And I guess in direct mail, there was a bit of that. I wouldn't say 40%, but
okay.
But it was a little better than that. But there was dreck. There was definitely dreck. I remember the percentage. And I think that's why I became a little bit of a celebrity for this particular angle, because it really started addressing the people who, and again, you know, a lot of people, like Jeff Walker always says, you know, he just believes in karma, you know, that all of those people won't be in business very long anyway. So,
well, it's true.
They give you a lot of agita and pain in the short term, and so they're a pain in the ass. But it would be nice, you know. Couldn't we all just get along, right?
Right. Well, Brian, this has been great. I just got one last question for you. You know, it seems like the world is in this massive transition where, well, everything is shifting around, right?
I mean,
you name it. We wouldn't even have to be talking about marketing. So let's say that we are talking to somebody who, you know, they've got their sea legs and they've had a few successes and they seem to know what's going on, but my goodness, like, it seems like every 3 months something just, you know, smacks them on the back of the head that they totally didn't see coming, and, you know, it erodes the confidence, and you're wondering, like, okay, is anything that I think I know actually true?
Right.
So that's our person. What do you say to that person who, you know, some mornings they're like, man, I'm a stud, and other mornings it's like, I don't even know if the sun is actually moving from east to west. It might have switched.
Right. That's a great question. Wow. I think, you know, and I know that you're a voracious reader of great marketing books and great things, and I think you said it to me in a previous call that I was talking about Gene Schwartz and Breakthrough Advertising, and that the book was written in 1966, and we haven't changed one word of it because it's about human behavior, and that hasn't changed. So maybe it's like, and then you called it the Breakthrough Advertising Effect, and you defined it, exceedingly rare gem that is just as true 51 years later as the day it rolled off the printing press, which I thought was brilliant. But take that a step further for this in this context. I think that, you know, trying to take a look at the key things that are going to always stand the test of time, which really probably go back to things like human behavior, buying behavior, and, you know, the people that have sort of struck gold on the internet with, you know, scarcity plays and special bonuses and, you know, endorse mailings, really great endorse mailings and affiliate programs. You know, what's old is new again, kind of thing. And so, again, I don't want to sound like Grandpa Dinosaur here, but I do think there's still gold in all of some of the great direct marketing books. I mean, Scientific Advertising still has great stuff in it that could be applied today. And you just never know with a great mind of today, of a great marketer of today, and I meet them all the time. It's like, I really do believe that, you know, there was a period when I was a list manager because the list business was pretty shady, as you said. Most times I was the smartest guy in the room. And I'm never the smartest guy in the room when I'm dealing in the masterminds I'm dealing with, which is really where I want to be. I never want to be. And I'm actually, you know, probably in the lower half of the room. And so what I love is that, so you have these fertile minds who know how to do, you know, it's like, what are you going to do with the technology? You're going to use it for good or evil, right? And so they have so much at their fingertips and so much dexterity in how they can manipulate, and I may say manipulate in the best way possible, the, you know, the marketing message and change it on the fly and do A/B testing on the fly. So those folks, if they're not, you know, the best ones I know are reading the great books of the past and looking at great techniques of the past and looking at great promotions of the past, not to copy them, but to create a 1+1=3, so that they've got talent that none, you know, there are guys, you know, sitting in that room where Gene Schwartz wouldn't be in the top half of the room. Well, maybe he would. Gene Schwartz was just a brilliant guy because he read everything. But would have no idea how to do a launch or no idea how to, you know, do a promotion online that works on steroids. But imagine giving all of that material to the rocket scientists of today. Doesn't that feel like a 1+1=3 or 9 or 20?
Well, it is. And, you know, Brian, you should never apologize, even if you are Grandpa Dinosaur.
No, I'm not.
You know, and I know you're not, but really, it's really the Grandpa Dinosaurs that are the ones that save you from this feeling of your feet never touching the bottom of the swimming pool. Because they're the ones that actually, they always know where the bottom is.
Right.
And so, like, I kind of have this philosophy that, yeah, you should probably know what's going on in the world, and it would be a good idea to know what's hot and what's selling now. That is important in marketing. But I also think you should be, like, reading stuff that's 100 years old.
No question.
Or even 500 years old, because that's the only way you develop a sense for what is permanent.
Yeah, I would quote a wise man. I think his name is Perry Marshall. Innovate yourself out of any corner that you back yourself into because you're too successful. You know, you've lived it, right? And you just gave me that quote, too, so thank you. But, you know, it's like stop reading your press clippings and get to work, you know. And, you know, I am enamored with so I call it the cowboys that I meet. I want to be one. You know, I want to be one that, you know, is strapped to a saddle on a really, really solid, four-footed, slow dinosaur. That's my image. That'll be my when I do the artwork. It's going to be, you know, Brian in a cowboy suit on top of the dinosaur. But I don't think cowboy is a negative term in my world, and dinosaur is not a negative term in my world.
Hey,
and both considered negative to some degree, as we talk about marketing. And man, you and I are simpatico. I mean, we're like, and you've got so much more experience online than I do. And that's why, but I respect you so much because of how you think. And there's a small group that are like that. And unfortunately, Perry, it's like it's on you to be the teacher mentor on all that. So
I got a new title for you, Brian.
Okay.
The Tyrannosaurus Rider of the Wild West.
I like it. Right, R-I-D-E-R.
That's right. That's okay. Right.
Perfect.
So, you know, the Wild West is like the bleeding edge of now, and Tyrannosaurus is like 60 million years old. And you know what? If you could do both, that's, man, you know, that packs a wallop.
You know what? I don't tell anybody. I might try to get the, I like T-Rex Rider.
Okay. Register it before I send out the CD.
Yep, absolutely. I better go get it.
Okay, Brian, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Perry, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
You bet.
All righty.
Adios.
Bye-bye.